Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Errol Yabake. And this week, we get back to actually talking about the news.
How about that?
And we end up spending a lot of time on this podcast episode talking about climate change because of the IPCC report that just came out this week and what it means and what we can do about it and how, you know, it sort of can affect whether or not we exist as humans in the next 150 years, which Mike, you and I won't be around for anyways.
A lot of ground to cover before that though, too. You know, I've been on vacation the last couple of weeks. A lot of things have happened. We'll talk about the Olympics. We'll talk about Tucker Carlson and Ron DeSantis, two of our faves on News and Brews. You know, we'll talk about Andrew Cuomo and Afghanistan and infrastructure. And there's a lot to catch up on. So I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And you've got some special beers that you've brought back with you from North Carolina. So really look forward to digging in on that.
With that, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Welcome, everyone.
Hey, Mike. It's good to see you again.
How you doing, Errol? Great to see you, too. We're recording on a platform with seeing this time, which is really fun.
We are. But I don't think that people who are listening to us can see us.
That's true. That's not how podcasts work.
But I can see you, and it's, you know, one of the first times in the last couple of weeks, because I think you've been on vacation.
I have. I've been on vacation for 2 weeks, which was pretty awesome. Also actually included like mostly a vacation from the news. So
that's great. You know,
to everyone, forgive me if my takes are both hot and rusty this week.
Did you take your kids on vacation with you?
I did.
Yeah. So it wasn't like a real vacation.
You know, having a two-year-old and a four-year-old around will keep you on your toes no matter how relaxing the rest of your surroundings are.
It's a different kind of work. Where did you go?
I spent a week in Asheville, North Carolina, which we'll get to when we talk about the brews. And then spent another week at the beach in Holden Beach, North Carolina.
Holden Beach?
Yeah, it's right on the southern tip of North Carolina, like sort of across the bay or cape. I don't know what you call it, but you can see Myrtle Beach at the top of South Carolina from Holden Beach.
Okay, so this is not Outer Banks, which is, I think, the only thing I know about the coast of North Carolina.
Right. But similarly, it's like a barrier island in just the same way they are. It's just south of the Outer Banks. Yeah, mostly spent the time that otherwise would have been devoted to news, just watching a ton of the Olympics and just like soaking in team handball. Mm. I love team handball with such a passion, and I'm only reminded of it every 4 years when it comes on the Olympics.
Why do we not have like an American handball team? Do we have an American?
I asked this very question of why handball is not like a thing in America on Twitter.
It needs to be a thing.
And got like all these responses from various handball clubs across the country. So
really,
it is a bit of a thing. And I actually looked it up. There is a handball club in DC, which I just earlier tonight signed up to go and join their practices. So this will be like a good test of whether Bree is listening to the podcast this week or whether she asked me why I went and signed up for handball. But we'll see. I'll report back if anything comes
up. Wait, so signed up to watch or play?
No. To go out and like try out for the team.
Wait, really?
Yeah, it's called the DC Diplomats Team Handball
Club.
Please
let me know how that goes. And I am definitely also in the ask for forgiveness, not permission camp on this one.
Yeah, it'll be potentially good.
That's awesome. I also watched an inordinate amount of Olympics in the last couple of weeks and came away really obsessed with water polo because holy shit. I don't know if you watched this, but like, especially the women's water polo.
Water polo is amazing. It's the handball of the sea.
It is kind of the handball of the sea. Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad that we agree on this, but I mean, first of all, the American women's team just utterly dominated. Mm-hmm. And it was just fascinating to like watch the extreme athleticism. The last time I felt this way about a sport I knew nothing about was when I went to years ago, Lauren and I went to a Aussie Rules football game. And I came away thinking like, these are the best athletes in the entire world. And watching an inordinate amount of women's water polo, I had the same impression.
For sure. It is awesome. The other one that I had never really seen before and just like came on the TV and I was fixated on it is marathon swimming.
I didn't realize that was a thing.
Yeah.
Like,
so they have
like 26 miles of swimming.
No, but 6 miles. It's like a 10,000 meter swim.
Jeez.
Yeah. It's wild. And like, they're just like out in the open water. It's not in a pool. It's like out in the river or the bay, you know, an open body of water. And the best part of it is it's long enough that you need to like hydrate mid race. So they hold out on like from like a dock, the hold out long poles with the flag of each country on the end, holding at the end of the pole a bottle of whatever drink the swimmer wants Whoa. To rehydrate. And they grab it as they go by, they flip over onto their back, and it's like an otter cracking a nut or something. They just like down it really quickly and keep swimming.
That is wild.
It's awesome.
That is awesome. Also, I did watch the women's actual marathon, like the running version, and the fact that we got a like unexpected bronze medal by this like really awesome American runner who, wait for it, it was her third marathon ever.
What?
Yeah, seriously. I think her last name was Seidel. She's from Wisconsin. And it was her second marathon ever was the one that she qualified for the Olympics in Atlanta. And her third marathon ever was in Sapporo, Japan for the Olympics. And she got third.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah, total boss. You know, speaking of Japan, I mean, I think that we've talked about it before in News and Brews, but I think there was a lot of apprehension and sometimes even animosity, sort of Japanese style animosity towards hosting them amongst the sort of local communities. But, you know, at least what I saw on the NBC streams is they really pulled it off. So, you know, hats off to Japan and everybody in Tokyo, and hopefully there aren't any long-term repercussions.
Yeah, the Olympics, like the rest of us, are just doing their best.
I felt like a very appropriate like COVID Olympics. I don't totally know what that means. Like, I have no frame of reference for what that means, but like it felt appropriate.
The one thing that I think was like maybe a little bit of an unexpected win was it did feel like the level of sportsmanship and camaraderie among athletes from different countries was at like a whole nother level after all these athletes had waited an extra year for the Olympics, trained through the pandemic. You just saw like a level of, I think, part joy to be doing what they're doing and just like solidarity with one another for the things they've achieved, which was really cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I wonder how much of that is because like we could hear everything, right? Like, I think that was a real thing that was happening. But I also think like, when the Italian high jumper and the Qatari high jumper sort of shared the gold medal and they all flipped out, like we heard every
that was really
like
cool.
Flamboyant Italian word that was uttered, and it was amazing. And I may or may not have cried a little bit.
So the one that sticks with me is that Australian swimmer who set the world record, and
and the coach
just realized it. Well, the coach went that was earlier, but when she realized it, like after the race ended and was like looking for someone to hug. And there were Americans on either side of her that just came over. And there was like basically four of them just like all celebrating together.
Yeah.
It was very cool.
I agree with all that. So Mike, you were on vacation. You watched a lot of Olympics, and I'm assuming since you were in, you know, Asheville, North Carolina, you were also drinking some brews.
So, great brewery town, Asheville. We've actually had some Asheville beers on in the past. This one that I'm drinking today, though, is very special. It is from a brewery called Ginger's Revenge, and this is their original ginger beer, which many people have had ginger beer from like the soda aisle in the supermarket, but this is alcoholic ginger beer, so it's 5.2% alcohol by volume. And I will say it's very ginger forward, as the name suggests, but like just really delightful too. It cleanses the palate. It's like a robust digestif. And it also happens to be gluten-free. And my take on it is like, if you're like me, you've had more than a few Snickers bars in your life that you justified because they have peanuts in them. Like, it's candy, but this part of it's healthy. And like, you sort of get that same feeling. Like, this is the beer version of that. Like, there's so much ginger in it. How bad could it be for you?
How bad
like,
could it be?
It's basically kombucha. Like, let's drink.
It's a cleanser. You're cleansing.
That's right.
It's great. Well, I am going with a tried and true. I love this brewery, the Solace Brewing Company, in part because they seem incapable of making normal size cans. And so they're all like a pint, which is delightful. And so I'm drinking the Partly Cloudy IPA, which for those that have been in DC this summer, there are these summer storms that seem to come almost like instantaneously and then are gone as soon as they come. And that was what happened this evening that we are recording. And so I pulled out the Partly Cloudy IPA for that purpose from Solace Brewing. And I have to say that the name is pretty accurate. And I feel like this is the beer I want. It's sort of like the hazy IPA that we've talked about, Mike, in the past. And it's the beer I want when I'm curled up during a storm, reading Lovely. A book while on staycation, which coincidentally is a preview of what I'm going to do after we're done here.
What a great staycation play. Love that.
Yeah.
All right. Should we get into the first round?
Let's do it.
Racist sack of jelly Tucker Carlson made news last week when he traveled to Hungary, delivering a speech at a new quasi-academic institute run by Hungarian borderline fascist president Viktor Orban and conducting an interview with the authoritarian leader that the Washington Post described as fawning, gushing, and central to grasping the Carlsonist right's true dream future. This is sort of like if the ghost of Christmas future showed Scrooge his own grave, and Scrooge was like, wow, that's awesome. No more grabby orphans asking for handouts anymore.
Yeah, that's funny. This trip was not really kind of gross. I also was wondering, did he wear a mask on the plane on his way over, or did he just like go in a rowboat so that he didn't have to wear a mask or something?
I don't know if the Fox News private jet has the same mask requirements as the rest of us.
Do you think he went on the Fox News private jet to this thing?
You think he's flying commercial?
That's a fair point. So, yeah, I mean, when I saw this news, I kept thinking about, like, in my day job, I think a lot about human mobility and migration and refugees and all that stuff. And you know, Viktor Orban is pretty much the example that I use in all of my research about what not to do, both in terms of its like inhumanity, but also in its counterproductivity with regards to migration policy. And so, you know, while this bromance is not surprising, it's really no less gross to me.
Yeah, very gross.
It also made me think about one of the books that I've been reading. I don't know about you, Mike, but I always have like three books that are unfinished on my bedside table. And one of them happens to be Ben Rhodes's new book called After the Fall, which essentially he starts in early 2017 and it sort of goes through kind of the decline of democracy. And it's telling that one of the first stories he tells very eloquently, Ben Rhodes, Love Him or Hate Him, is a great writer. It's a very good, accessible book. And he starts out the book essentially with discussions with Hungarian opposition politicians and sort of civil society, you know, nonprofit folks. Quite frankly, it's harrowing what they're going through. You know, it's really, again, not surprising, but also really gross that Tucker Carlson was going there to celebrate what Viktor Orban is doing, because Orban is not someone to be celebrated.
And they're basically celebrating like all the overtly terrible things. It's like the anti-immigration, the anti-civil society. Like it's entirely quiet part out loud.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, I don't know enough about Hungarian politics to know why and how they've stayed in power, but this is, you know, this is what other sort of leaders with autocratic tendencies are doing around the world, which is part of the premise of Ben Rhodes's After the Fall book.
Yeah. Are you enjoying that book, by the way?
I am enjoying that book. I think I'm one of these people that like has an abiding sense of optimism and would like to think that people are good and that we can sort of move towards progress, whether the, you know, arc of justice is flat, or, you know, it's sort of longer term, it's bumpy along the way or not. Like, I feel like we should be moving forward. And I think this book is sort of a sobering reminder that while that may be true in some cases, there's a lot of people hell bent on making sure that it's not true.
Yeah. I've not read it, but, you know, I listen to Ben Rhodes every week on Pod Save the World. And I find his framing of kind of what's happening in the world to be helpful. I'm not a scholar of international relations, so I'm sure that a lot of this is not, you know, not original to him, but just, you know, the pitting of democracy against authoritarianism and regressive politics, the prioritization of some of these issues, like that we saw at the G7 this year around climate and pandemic prevention and these more cooperative issues, as opposed to the post 9/11 counterterrorism age, I find really useful.
Yeah, I think that's all right. And I think, you know, the criticism against Ben is that he's, you know, made some enemies or something, or, you know, maybe said some things. And, you know, he likes to call people like me who are part of the DC kind of foreign policy establishment, if you will, the blob. That's like his famous term for people like me. And, but at the same time, like, I really appreciate him because he's a communicator first who kind of fell into foreign policy. Hmm. And so he always thinks about foreign policy from a communications standpoint. And to me, that's not like, oh, he's just trying to like whitewash whatever's going on. It's like, he's actually trying to tell the story of what's happening in a more accessible way. And I think that's, I felt that way about his first book, and I have definitely felt that way about this one as well.
Just to put a fine point on the Tucker Carlson trip to Hungary, you know, I think equally disquieting to this like general unholy bromance is this bigger picture proto-Trotskyist effort to internationalize the reactionary ethno-nationalism of the far right. Like, Steve Bannon has tried to do this for years. Yep. He's failed at it a couple of different times. And you now have Orban basically trying to position Budapest as the epicenter of a global movement, now with the backing and amplification of Rupert Murdoch's Fox News and Tucker Carlson.
Yeah. I mean, he tried to do this in Italy and elsewhere and sort of was unsuccessful. And so I think it's Tucker Carlson's taking the mantle up. I think it's worth remembering, though, that Hungary is a member of the EU. And, you know, as all this is going on, I, you know, would like to see the EU talk about some principles. It can be behind closed doors. It doesn't need to be naming and shaming out loud, which we know is counterproductive in instances. But I'd like to see your move, EU.
I think for a lot of lay people, myself included, it's not really clear. Like, clearly Hungary is out of step with the ideals of Western democracy and the principles on which the EU was founded. What can the EU actually do about that, or other member states?
Yeah, I mean, Hungary benefits a lot from being in the European Union. And I think that there have got to be ways, again, not public, not naming and shaming, but there's got to be ways that their influence can be limited within the EU system. I mean, part of what makes what I just said challenging is that the EU oftentimes operates on sort of a consensus basis. It's not a majority rule. It's like everybody has to agree, and everybody anywhere doesn't agree on anything. So I don't know why they set the system up like that, but basically, you know, when the EU is coming up with, for example, an asylum policy or a migration policy or something, like, Hungary can assert its kind of veto power in a way. And so maybe this is a time to consider some broader EU reforms, especially if the sort of democratic project that is the European Union is threatened by an anti-democratic leader of a European Union state.
Yeah.
From one anti-democratic state to another.
In Florida. A federal judge ruled that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis cannot ban Norwegian cruise lines from requiring all passengers on their ships leaving Miami to be vaccinated against the coronavirus. Fortunately for Ron DeSantis, if it's sick cruise passengers he wants, there's no vaccine mandate in place for norovirus, Brainerd's diarrhea, tuberculosis, diphtheria, Legionnaires' disease, rubella, influenza, or any of the other horrible plagues that tend to befall cruise ships. Bon voyage.
Have you ever been on a cruise, Mike?
No, I haven't. Can you tell?
Yeah, no, it's funny because I feel like Lauren and I are both quite anti-cruise. You know, Norwegian Cruise Lines, call us. But this was definitely a funny one because it was just so blatant what he was trying to do, but also like you're trying to regulate one thing out of many gross things that happen on cruise lines.
Yeah. The cruise that I'd be really excited to do would be like Alaska in the summer.
Yeah. We did Antarctica. That's the only cruise went on. That was pretty awesome. It was like a converted, speaking of Norway, it was a converted, I think, Norwegian ferry that was like strong enough to go across the Drake Passage from the southern tip of South America over to Antarctica. And so we spent 11 days on that thing. And it was pretty epic, but it was also, I think, very like unnormal cruise. Like there weren't, you know, there wasn't like Poker Night and, you know, the like Broadway show on the high seas. It was like, let's have a learning session about penguins.
Yeah. So it was like your kind of cruise.
So it was like my kind of cruise. Yeah.
Nice. Moving on to New York. Governor Andrew Cuomo announced on Tuesday he will resign within 14 days. The announcement comes in the face of an impending impeachment investigation in the state assembly following Attorney General Letitia James's damning report detailing Cuomo's sexual harassment of 11 women, including several employees and a state trooper he requested to be on his personal security detail. Any potential impeachment hearings would have also covered a smattering of other alleged crimes, including the underreporting of deaths in nursing homes from COVID-19, doling out priority access to COVID vaccines for family members, and new allegations detailed in a New Yorker article from Ronan Farrow that Cuomo had called the Obama White House railing against then U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, who had been looking into potential corruption in the Cuomo administration, in a possible violation of state ethics rules and other laws.
A lot here. Yeah.
A lot here. I, for one, Errol, am glad he's resigning. It's the only chance I have to move this massive inventory of Cuomo sexual mugs I've been sitting on. Now they could be for any Cuomo. Chris, radiologist and author Margaret Cuomo, film producer Maria Cuomo. So many more sexy Cuomos to choose from now.
And by mugs, you mean like coffee mugs?
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, no, it's a really sad story seeing the sort of how quickly he fell from grace. But
yeah, I think the whole saga really of Andrew Cuomo, like in the last 18 months, highlights a couple ways our culture is deeply broken.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think like if there were any such thing as Trump derangement syndrome, it was this draw to anything baseline competent or anti-Trump that I think the whole moment Andrew Cuomo had in 2020 will come to be seen as the height of. There were people calling on Joe Biden to have his DNC delegates switch to voting for Cuomo at the convention like barely a year ago.
Yeah, part of that was, you know, he was also just such an entertainer. Like Cuomo's right. Daily briefs were like going viral. And I think it's this sort of another thing that highlights ways that our culture is broken is the deification of people who can communicate like that.
Yep. And totally agree with that. I think my mom just pointed out that Cuomo and Trump in terms of governing style are very similar as well, which I think is a fair point.
Yes. Cindy Heslin is listening in on the Zoom, which is pretty awesome. I'm here.
I think
for
it's, it's also, you know, can be seen, I think, as sort of a collective response to the trauma that we were all immersed in the early pandemic days as well, just a sort of a flight to any semblance of competence. But I also think that, like, it's been suspected that this guy was a creep and a sexual harasser for years, but it has been known with certainty that he was abusive in other ways professionally, right?
Yeah.
Belittled staff members. He created a toxic work environment. And it was very much not even an open secret. It was just known. It was a known fact about the governor. And I think the fact that we need a sexual angle for abuse to matter is fundamentally not healthy.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I think toxicity comes in a lot of forms. Also, you know, I mentioned I'm on staycation, and one of the things that I sort of fell into, you mentioned Ronan Farrow, and I've been watching Catch and Kill, the podcast tapes on HBO Max, which is basically Ronan Farrow talking about how he got into Harvey Weinstein, and ultimately sort of led to him breaking the story in the New Yorker. He tried to publish it in NBC, and sort of for a whole host of reasons, it got bumped to the New Yorker. And it was all kind of happening at the beginning of the Me Too movement. And, you know, one of the things that I liked about the show is, and continue to like about the show, is that he goes out of his way to applaud the bravery of the women. You know, as you were talking, I was sort of feeling the same way about the women who came forward about Andrew Cuomo. And I wonder if they're I think the Me Too moment is really important, and I hope it stays, quite frankly, forever. Not stays in that it's needed to stay, but just sort of this kind of removal of sexual toxicity from everywhere is something that I can absolutely support. And I also would agree with you that I think sort of moving beyond toxicity in general is where I really hope this goes. So, you know, this, you've been seeing a lot of this, like, some people have called it the I'm a dinosaur excuse, like, oh, you know, things have changed and I haven't adapted with the times. You know, I'm a dinosaur. Like, that's just not going to excuse your predatory behavior. So everybody just needs to stop. Please, right. Please stop.
On to our main stories.
You know, as I was thinking about main stories this week, it was hard for me, Mike, to not think about Afghanistan. In my world, in the foreign policy world, it's been very much top of mind for people, and people have been writing about it and talking about it. And the reason is because the Taliban is absolutely on the offensive. I think that, you know, people don't realize that the Taliban has been around this entire time. It wasn't like, you know, we invaded Afghanistan in late 2001 and started bombing and Tora Bora and all this stuff, and like the Taliban just vanished. Like, no, they've been around for 20 years. They've been around for more, but after we sort of intervened in Afghanistan, they've been around. And I think, you know, in the past just week, they have really, really intensified their offensive. On Friday alone, as of last Friday, they had taken control of at least six major cities across the country, including several regional capitals. And that's important because the Taliban has primarily before sort of been a rural entity. They've always had designs on urban areas, but it's harder to control a city than it is to control a village, right? And, you know, they're not only controlling cities, they're starting to go into big places like Herat. I used to live in Herat in Western Afghanistan. It's about 50 kilometers from the Iranian border and is kind of a commercial hub for both licit and illicit goods sort of to and from Iran. But it, essentially there's quite a bit of money there. And so the Taliban have done things like, you know, essentially robbing the bank, kind of targeting very deliberately places that will help them in the long run. You know, as I was thinking about this, and I want to hear how you're thinking about this too, Mike, but I think it's really easy for people to say, like, oh, the U.S. is pulling out, this announcement by Joe Biden, things are going to shit, you know, therefore A led to B. And I think that that's certainly incomplete thinking, because even if the U.S. had not said that they were pulling out, it's sort of, I asked myself, like, was this foreseeable? And I think the answer is yes. I mean, the Taliban was sort of gaining strength, and there was less willingness of not just the United States, but all sort of NATO-led, you know, partners to sort of control far-flung areas. That wasn't a thing that was in the cards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so would it have mattered if the U.S. hadn't said it was going to pull out? Like, doubtful, in my humble opinion. Like, I actually think that this was sort of a preordained thing in a way that, you know, keeping our couple thousand troops there wasn't actually gonna stop.
Yeah, you and I have had some longer conversations about this, particularly on News and Brews in the pre-podcast era. And I think, you know, hearing your perspective, having lived there, researching other kind of firsthand perspectives on what's been happening over there in advance of that conversation, having researched a number of firsthand perspectives on the war and the situation in Afghanistan in preparation for that conversation, I think there's a lot of value in removing the US from the center of the conversation to the point that, and basically recentering the perspective of a typical Afghani citizen, right? Where the announcement of the US that it's withdrawing troops isn't the end of anything, right? It's a continuation of an extended conflict that these people have been in the middle of for decades now, you know, by some measures, like 4 decades. And I think to expect that there would be a resolution at this point is would have been naive. Certainly, you have to see the removal of U.S. troops as, you know, a tactical victory for the Taliban and you know, creating some space and some vulnerability for them to exploit. I think that's consistent with the assessment of U.S. intelligence as well. But to see this as the beginning or the end or even too much of a phase change, I think, is what this looks like to the U.S. as opposed to what the reality is on the ground.
I would agree with all that. And I think we generally in our foreign policy have to take a less U.S.-centric approach to understanding challenges. I think we in U.S. foreign policy understandably need to take a U.S.-centric approach because it's U.S. You know, we need to do things that are sort of beneficial to our national security and stuff. Like I get all that and I agree with all that. But I think in understanding the situation, it's much more useful to think about what Afghans are going through, which is quite frankly, right now, they're thinking about survival. And so survival for Afghans right now, as far as I can tell, is either get the hell out of Dodge, either try to, you know, leave the country or go to another city or go to a rural area or something, especially if you've had some interaction with or ties to the government or even worse, you know, a foreign entity, the U.S. or otherwise, like you need to kind of get out of Dodge, or it's kind of adapting and putting your head down. Mike, there was this really sad, in my personal opinion, thing that happened recently on one of these 6 cities that fell was a really major city of 250,000 people called Kunduz in northern Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And by some reports, the Taliban were cheered as they entered this city. And I was sort of caught thinking like, oh, is this, you know, have they won the hearts and minds? And it's like, no, I think it's just that Afghans are smart. And they are, you know, doing what they need to do to survive.
Yeah, that's really striking.
As I look ahead, I don't think the Taliban's interested in peace. And so I think it's the best case scenario is sort of like, how can the U.S. and its allies be a part of some sort of power sharing agreement that involves the Taliban? Violent conflict is going to be in Taliban's future for some time. And I'd like to think that we can figure out ways of, you know, maintaining some of the gains that have been achieved over the past couple of decades, you know, like, you know, keeping girls in school and allowing women to continue to work. But I think especially in the Taliban held areas, you know, that's going to be certainly challenging in the short term.
What do you think the outlook is for some kind of diplomatic or political solution that results in some level of stability, given the current situation?
Bad. You know, I think the Taliban, I have no direct line on this, but my sense just following them for a couple of decades now is that, you know, they really would like to be in power. And that's not a power sharing agreement. That's like, you know, we've got, you know, we're controlling the presidential palace in Kabul. And I think that they're, unless there's some sort of, you know, military setback, I think that's what they're going for, which is, I think we need to figure out how we're going to provide support. And again, it's worth me pointing out, like, I'm not sure that the, you know, less than 5,000 US troops that were still there would have been able to stop what's going on now. And I'm not even sure that they would have been, that the Taliban would have been deterred had we not made this announcement. So I, again, sort of, you know, not assigning causality to the U.S. decision with what's going on now. But I do think that the U.S., I'm sure there are behind the scenes discussions about, you know, how do we consolidate social and economic gains, and how do we figure out how to keep the Taliban out of Kabul?
Yeah, you know, my first thought would be, okay, there's, you know, clearly a rebalancing of military power happening. They'll fight to a stalemate, and then they'll figure out something politically. But how do you define a stalemate when you've been at war for 40 years?
Yeah, I think that's right. And your mom makes an excellent point about protecting people who need protection right now. And I mentioned the people who worked with the U.S. in particular, not just translators, but when I was in Afghanistan, I worked on a U.S. government funded project, and there were lots of friends and colleagues that I had on the Afghan side that just by virtue of them sharing an office with me, their lives would probably be at risk. You know, we need to help those people. They were there for us, and we need to be there for them.
Yeah, sure.
Another main story that I was thinking about, Mike, and I want to spend most of the rest of our time on climate change and the IPCC report that came out this week. But I do think it's worth mentioning that the Senate passed an infrastructure bill. You know, a while back on News and Brews, we were sort of talking about how there was this meeting at the White House and Joe Biden came out with like Republican and Democratic senators and announced that like, we have a deal. And nobody had seen the deal, and it seemed very premature, and sort of the cynics in the media, and quite frankly, me, I don't remember if I said this out loud or not, but I was sort of wondering like, ooh, was that a premature announcement? And, you know, Joe Biden has sort of proved me and everybody else wrong that, you know, that there are ways to do bipartisanship today that are pretty meaningful, quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the Senate just passed a $1 trillion infrastructure bill, 69 to 30. Part of those 69 yes votes was, wait for it, Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. You know, you've got two former senators and the president and vice president. And, you know, maybe there's some value in that is showing.
Well, and just Joe Biden's dogged belief in bipartisanship. You know, I feel like so many people have thought that that's dead. And I think that there is something to his just total refutation of that belief. Like he has this belief in the Senate, especially as an institution of U.S. politics, that I don't know. It's not just that I'm on my second beer. I feel like I'm motivated by this, by what happened on the infrastructure bill.
Sure. Maybe there's a chance for bipartisanship when Democrats are controlling both houses of Congress and the White House, even if by narrow margins. What happens if Republicans take one or both houses in 2022? I don't know that that necessarily helps the prospects of getting other big things done on a bipartisan basis. What jumps out at you, Errol, is in terms of what's in the bill?
Yeah, I mean, just on that last point that you made, I mean, this is sort of, you know, it passed the Senate, and now it's going to the House. And that point that you made is exactly why I think it will eventually pass the House, because I don't think if there is a change in the midterms, especially, and that's the fear amongst Democrats, that, you know, there's even less of a window for bipartisanship and quite frankly, getting anything done. So I think that, you know, there's lots of talk about, you know, progressives want more, you know, childcare needs to be infrastructure and all this stuff that we've talked about on News and Brews before. But I don't necessarily believe that Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats are going to deny what is by most accounts a pretty significant victory for Joe Biden.
Well, I do think this is one case where progressive Democrats are holding a lot of cards now as well, right? So they've said, and this was the Progressive Caucus in the House led by Pramila Jayapal, conducted a survey of its members and said, we are not going to vote yes on this bipartisan infrastructure bill until we have a reconciliation bill passed through the Senate. that has the rest of the Build Back Better agenda in it, including those things you mentioned, like childcare, elder care, climate change mitigation, you know, the other priorities that weren't able to be passed in, you know, revenue generation, some other things, weren't able to be passed in the bipartisan bill, are now all on the table in the reconciliation bill. And House Democrats are basically saying, we're not going to pass anything until we see that reconciliation bill.
You know, it's notable that the next vote after the 69-30 vote was actually a 50-49 vote to move forward on a $3.5 trillion budget. That includes,
which is that bill. That is the reconciliation bill.
Essentially, that's just sort of an agreement to open up debate, and it remains to be seen if the Kristen Sinemas and the Joe Manchins stay on the bus throughout the course of this. But I think that there is room to feel like, you know, Jayapal's strategy and the progressive Democrats, like, it sounds like Democrats can have their cake and eat it too here. There's miles to go before we sleep, but it seems like Joe Biden's $66 billion for passenger and freight rail, because it's Joe Biden, so of course there was passenger and freight rail in, you know, broadband investments that are, I think, pretty significant, you know, $65 billion for broadband. And Mike, I'd love your thoughts on the $15 billion for electric vehicles. But I think that there's reason to believe that this could actually happen, and that the reconciliation process could do the rest of it.
Yeah, it is, to quote our current president, a big fucking deal. Something you didn't mention is the $55 billion for water systems and infrastructure. They're going to entirely eliminate lead pipes throughout the United States. Like, that's a huge deal.
Retweet equals endorsement. Yes.
You know, you mentioned the $15 billion for electric vehicles. There's $7.5 billion for EV charging infrastructure specifically in there.
Wow.
That'll be a huge step forward for our transportation network and the electrification thereof. There's a lot to like in even just, you know, before you get into any part of the reconciliation bill, even in this bipartisan deal.
Is your next car going to be an electric vehicle, Mike?
It'll at least be a plug-in.
So yes, is the answer to that question.
Yeah, at least a plug-in hybrid. We're looking at some options for our listeners. You know, our car lease is up toward the end of this year, and we're thinking about the next move. And there are enough options out there now that, like, we don't have to go out and buy a $100,000 Tesla in order to have a vehicle that plugs in and can get us around town without burning gas. So we're going to go for it.
Yeah, we were looking at the Volkswagen one. I mean, the challenge for us is a slight tangent, but the challenge for us is that we don't have a garage space. And mm-hmm. So, you know, if you do street parking in a major US city, for example, like, where do you charge? Tying it back to the infrastructure thing that we were just talking about, this could actually be something that pushes people like the Abacays over the line to be able to get an electric vehicle.
Totally, totally. Yeah, we don't have a garage, but we do have a driveway. And we recently did a home renovation, and we had them install a high voltage outlet on the outside of our house at the end of the driveway.
Nice.
So we've got it set up for, you know, hopefully fast charging if and when that happens.
Well, listeners, we have a new Twitter handle at News and Brews Pod. So send Mike all of your EV recommendations.
Beautiful.
Because it looks like he's going to get one before the year's end.
All right, moving on. As you mentioned, Errol, we do want to spend some time talking about climate. And there's been a lot of news here, right? 3 weeks ago, we talked before the show about the floods happening in Germany, in China, across Europe, which killed over 180 people and are costing the German government $68 billion in relief funding. At the time, we bumped it off the agenda for something else. And part of our justification in doing that was, we'll have more natural disasters to talk about soon enough. Sure enough, it's time for our next show, and the world is properly on fire right now. In Southern Europe, they're experiencing what Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis has called a natural disaster of unprecedented proportions, as wildfires rage across Greece, Turkey, Italy, and other countries amid a record-breaking heat wave. Those fires have destroyed more than 200,000 acres of forest in Greece alone. And you always hear about fires in the U.S., like when they're burning an area the size of New York City or the size of Manhattan. In Greek terms, 200,000 acres is 20 times the area of Athens.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, there were some really startling images coming out of Greece, like people basically, like, with two suitcases getting on ferries trying to just like get out to sea to avoid the fires. I mean, mm-hmm. just really terrible in the middle of the pandemic.
Well, and you also have, you know, a public sector in Greece that has not been traditionally thought of as the most efficient or effective. And so there are a lot of people who just sort of accepted at one point that help wasn't coming. And you've had like entire towns standing shoulder to shoulder with fire hoses, trying to turn the fires away from their village. You know, you've had others kind of as individuals trying to step up and become first responders on the spot. There's some really harrowing stories and images coming out of there.
Yeah, which we sort of assign these, you know, apocalyptic images almost automatically to like, oh, this is probably happening in California. And I think that this is one of the more significant and early times that we've seen it happening outside the United States. And so I think when I was doing research into kind of the impact of climate change on migration last year, I was, when you think about wildfires displacing people, it's essentially the United States, some parts of Canada, and some parts of Israel, which have traditionally been thought of as places that have wildfires. And like with most effects of climate change, the sort of places that are going to have to add this to the list of considerations is growing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned California. And there, the Dixie Fire has destroyed 500,000 acres. So that's relative to the 200,000 in Greece, making it the largest fire in the state's history, overcoming the previous record holder for a single fire, which happened last fall.
Yeah.
And still just half the acreage of the largest ever complex fire, which is when a bunch of smaller fires meet up and their powers combine, like Captain Planet, but the exact opposite. That complex fire happened all the way back last summer.
Yeah, I was thinking about this as I was like, didn't we just see this movie?
Mm-hmm.
We did. It was
basically every year now, it seems. Against this backdrop, the UN's International Panel on Climate Change put out a report saying we are basically now locked into a minimum 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in global average temperatures over the 19th century baseline, which in practical terms represents a step change in the wrong direction from even our current situation, where we've currently seen a rise of 1.1 degrees. But as you get from 1.1 to 1.5, that means there are a billion more people vulnerable to life-threatening heat waves each summer, severe droughts affecting hundreds of millions of people, the extinction of several animal and plant species, and the acceleration in the die-offs of coral reefs around the world, a significant jump in extreme weather events. And this is all literally now the best case scenario.
Yeah. You know, the report talks about like, basically the ship has sailed until at least 2050, which mm-hmm. for me means like I'll be retirement age in 2050. And so I think, you know, this basically means that we're in a, well, I guess this is the situation that we're going to have to deal with for the next 30 years. So let's figure out how to adapt to it. And the mitigation part, the sort of reversal of the warming and the other really negative parts of climate change is a conversation that is for our kids and our grandkids, which is sort of hard, I feel like, from a policy perspective, because people respond to things that are of immediate concern. And I think that the thing that I really appreciated, also terrifying, but like appreciated about this particular report was that they sort of unequivocally talk about how humans are to blame mm-hmm. for this. And there's no insinuation. It's us. We're doing this. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be part of the furniture for the next 30 years.
Yeah. And you can tell in the way the report's written, in the way it's covered, that they're really trying to walk a fine line between acknowledging how bad things are and how much we have already screwed ourselves, but balancing that against, you know, sort of the fact that there are still ways that we collectively can help, right? And there are still ways to make it not as bad as it could get.
Totally. And I think that a report like this has to do that. The challenge also is that the places that are the main places responsible for this, so the global north, sort of rich countries that are you know, disproportionately carbon emitters, they're probably going to be fine because they have the wealth to be able to adapt. And so like most things, sort of the sort of rich world or the first world or global north does something and it disproportionately negatively impacts the global south. I think where in the report sort of points this out in much more diplomatic terms than I just laid out, but I think the focus is going to have to be helping those places adapt. Like, we'll be fine, Mike, in the United States of America and in a place like Washington, D.C. Like, it's going to get hotter. It's going to get more annoying. But we're going to have to put more resources and efforts into those developing countries that are disproportionately negatively affected. And that's just a really hard sell, generally speaking. I'd welcome your thoughts on sort of what we can do differently here, because I think we need to ratchet up. This sort of IPCC report seemed to get more news coverage than previous ones.
I have to think that part of that is the fact that we are in the middle of all of these major disasters happening all around the world. It's fire season, it's flood season, it's almost hurricane season, where these effects become very tangible.
I thought it was already hurricane season. Is it like always hurricane season?
Yeah, maybe we're already there. But
so you were just in North Carolina, so you're the world's expert.
But this is all coming in as a prelude to the COP26 summit happening later this year. What's your sense in kind of the chatter you've been hearing about the prospects for real progress and concrete steps that might actually make a difference at that summit?
I mean, I think that there will be a lot of announcements, or as people in political world called announceables. Like, the US and other G20 countries and countries around the world are putting together their announceables, their list of things that they can announce in a press release. And like most things, it's going to be about the sort of proof in the pudding. And in the United States, there's some things that we can do with executive action. But as we saw during the Trump years, things that were done through executive action can be easily reversed. And so, I'd like to see some sort of legislation following up with this. Again, we just spent a lot of time talking about bipartisanship and how difficult it is. So, I'm not holding my breath, but I think there's going to be a lot of announcements. I think that, countries like the Nordics, Australia and Japan and some other places are a little bit more on the direct receiving end. They have the means with which to adapt, but they are feeling it a little bit. We are also feeling it in the United States, but we seem politically incapable of doing anything about it, which is not the case in some of those other places. So I say that because I think that you'll see commitments that are a little bit more concrete coming out of places like that. I know that the Biden team is putting together their list right now, and they're wanting to lead in ways that the U.S. certainly hasn't led for the past 4 years. And even before that, it was sort of all the efforts were about negotiating the Paris climate deal. Yep. And this COP26 is about, like, how do we actually make that happen in practice?
Yeah. Yeah. For us, it all comes down to the reconciliation bill again. Getting back to your last question, the thing that's most clear to me from this is just that it's not going to stop.
Yeah.
Right. We had news about this 3 weeks ago. We had more news about it 3 days ago. We had more news about it today. And there will be something new next week. And if you're a believer in science or just an observer of the consistent drumbeat over the last 20 years of all the scary predictions coming true, it's going to keep getting consistently worse unless and until it starts getting much worse. We talk about the news here. So I wanted to spotlight an opportunity I see for the news media, which is, I think we've gotten beyond both sides in climate science for the most part, good, but it's time to shape and drive this narrative with much more purpose. It's not political, it's existential. With the Delta variant popping up, you saw the New York Times go back and add a COVID section again to its main navigation bar in its mobile app.
Yeah, I saw that.
They can do that. Do the same with climate, right? Do the same with climate for the next few decades until we figure this out. If you're at The Economist, or you're at The Washington Post or the BBC, make climate a distinct section on your site with prominent placement. Keep this top of mind. Like, we need to do that all the time.
For those that are not able to see what's going on, which is basically everybody listening to that, I was nodding that entire time.
We talk about being in a recovery phase economically and kind of in the general zeitgeist of how things feel in America right now. And you know, we talked about the infrastructure bill clearing the Senate, being a part of that momentum. But like young people right now, millennials and Gen Z, have never known an economic situation that was anything except recovery or extreme crisis. Since 2008.
Yeah.
Right. That is an indicator that we need to recover from something that's much more long-term than we typically talk about on our weekly news podcast. If we still want to have a human race living on Earth in, say, 150 years, the first thing we need to do is fix what we've done to the climate in the last 150 years. This is the key enabler of our longer arc of recovery.
Yeah, I think that's a really critical point. And it just sort of makes me think there's an excellent podcast called How to Save a Planet, which is Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson and the guy who does Gimlet, Alex Bloomberg. There's a great podcast called How to Save a Planet with Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson and Alex Bloomberg. And their March 18th episode actually is called Is Your Carbon Footprint BS? And it gets to this point, Mike, where they're basically talking about individual actions versus policy and other sort of big actions. And I think what you said about kind of the survival of the human race, you know, if the New York Times adds a section, I think it'll sort of guarantee the survival of the human race. So we probably don't need to worry about it as long as the New York Times does what you said.
We're all fixing it here.
Yeah, we're all about the fixing. But essentially, the point on this podcast episode, which I would commend to all listeners, is essentially this is not just about human behavior. It's about policy that forces behavior. And I think we are in this phase, as evidenced by the IPCC report, where this is a policy challenge, which is, of course, political. But it means that we're going to have to make big changes. We're going to have to force not only humans, but companies and governments and societies to do things differently. It's not going to be enough if Mike and I go vegan, which quite frankly, I'm not going to do.
For sure. Well, I think that's an inspirational note on which to end it, Errol.
Yeah. Well, like with most things, I think, Mike, you know, on climate change and other things, I think we fixed it.
Safe to say we fixed it.
Yeah. I mean, the New York Times edition thing is actually a good fix. Like that's like a fixed thing. We fixed it.
We asked them to fix it.
We asked them to fix it, which is basically the same thing, right? All right. Well, good to see you. Good to hear you. Welcome
you too,
back
Ralph.
From vacation, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, everyone. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yaboke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Tuesday, August 10th, 2021 at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.